and because we will be doing a moderately deep dive into the human auditory system. But it would be hard to appreciate what our auditory system is doing without understanding acoustics. And so we got to discuss both. Now, as I mentioned, I have two parts to this presentation, and I want to emphasize their dependence on one another. Tonight, I will focus on acoustics, and Wednesday on the biophysics of the auditory system itself. And so the two parts very much depend on one another. To be honest, if you miss one, you're missing a substantial part of the presentation. So that's my little marketing, I don't know, condemnation, whatever that is. So if you leave feeling tonight like there was no point to any of this, come back Wednesday, and maybe that will help. Now, my purpose in examining the auditory system is because it's one of the most complex and least understood parts of the human body. Likely because the heavy processing is done in the brain. You know that old adage, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? Well, yes and no. If no one's around to hear it, then no, not really. Because your brain's got to process it. And I also think it poses a challenge to Darwinists to explain how the auditory system came about. Now, we've seen this quote from Darwin several times, where he says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find no such case. Well, Charles, of course you can't. Neither can you demonstrate that it could ever happen, because you have never observed macroevolution. And we have been and continue to find fully formed organisms as fossils. So still to this day, no one has ever demonstrated macroevolution. And you can't demonstrate the opposite of what hasn't been demonstrated in the first place. If it was clearly demonstrated, we wouldn't be having this series. So great job, Charles, creating a logically circular abyss that we've had to deal with 150 years. It's getting old. Pardon me, but all of this stuff, this twisted nature of evolutionary philosophy, makes me sarcastic. I digress. But part of my title is I want to use music, the auditory system, as a case for intelligent design. Nowadays, this is treated by the new atheists. The new atheists is a group of people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and others, who categorize people who still disagree with the evolutionary theory as redneck idiots who are just stubborn and ignorant, or maybe even wicked, as Dawkins suggested. They also propose that science and faith are at odds with each other. This is simply not true. In fact, one only need do some cursory reading of the history of science to see that the pioneers of the scientific revolution, which occurred around 1500 to 1750, in other words, the founders of the scientific method of modern science, the way we do it, they used the existence of God and the idea of creation as their foundation for inquiry. In fact, I got ahead of myself. So intelligent design was part of the underlying worldview of the scientific revolution. Think people like Robert Boyle, father of chemistry, Kepler, Galileo, Copernicus, Isaac Newton. He was an idiot, wasn't he? In his book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, which just came out this year, Dr. Stephen Meyer discusses the idea that these scientists' faith is not just coincidental. They just happen to believe in God too. But actually, that it was a key element that facilitated their achievements and is likely the explanation behind why this revolution occurred during that time in human history, as opposed to the sophisticated civilizations which came before. Have you thought about that? Why did the scientific revolution happen between 1500 and 1750? There were other big civilizations prior to that that did cool things. The Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks. Why didn't they come up with a scientific method? A method of studying the world empirically like we have now. Well, Dr. Meyer says it's because the missing key here was the Judeo-Christian worldview. That when you believe in a personal God who can make choices, that motivated them to look at the world more closely as it is. Whereas the Greeks would kind of start with a general premise about the way the world should be based on ideals and deduce things from there. But in the 1500s, that started to change. So they used empirical evidence to study the world as it actually is, believing that they would find order. And they certainly did. Here's something that Isaac Newton wrote. If you listen to atheists today, you have no idea that Newton felt this way. How came the bodies of animals to be contrived with so much art? And for what ends were their several parts? Was the eye contrived without skill in optics? And the ear without knowledge of sounds? And these things being rightly dispatched, does it not appear from phenomena that there is a being incorporeal, living, intelligent, omnipresent? Who is Newton again? Newton is the person who discovered what we call the law of gravity, which is really just an observation of how nature works over and over and over and over and over. And he saw the laws of nature as evidence. Obviously, how could this happen without something behind it? He would agree with what we've already said in Romans 1:20 a lot. For his invisible attributes, God's, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Clearly perceived. From the things that are made, what is clearly perceived? Eternal power and divine nature. If there's one thing that everybody can agree on, I think, when you look at the world around you and you see the staggering complexity of the things that are going on, everybody has to agree that whatever put this world together is extremely powerful. Would you agree? I mean, come on. The difference is, what do you think that power is? And the Bible says, we don't have any excuse not to know, people. So, enough introduction. So we will not really be looking at the Bible much tonight because the Bible says we don't have to in order to perceive certain things about God. Supernatural qualities about him and his intelligence. So, my objectives tonight are pretty simple. One, I want your brain to explode. Because when we look at the things that are made, we should be in awe of them. In fact, people are. I mean, you watch a nature program, and even though they're spouting evolution the whole time, you hear a sense of reverence in their voice about nature. But it takes some time. You've got to spend a little time to examine closely. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And I want your brain to explode. And then I want you to believe that macroevolution stinks. That's a very proper scientific statement. But the mechanisms that the general theory of evolution uses to describe how things came about, random mutation with no direction whatsoever, and natural selection, those are severely inadequate to describe the complexity of what we see. So I hope that by the end of these two sessions, you will come away with some of these things. Obviously, I don't have time to go into the exhaustive discussion of all of these, but even a little bit, I'll take it. All right. So, in the context of our brains exploding, what we're going to talk about is what is a musical tone? Some questions we're going to ask. And why does one instrument playing a musical tone sound different than another instrument playing that same tone? For example, a trumpet versus a violin. Also, why do some notes sound good together while others do not? And then some basics about how do we hear all of this? So these are some simple questions, but actually trying to answer these questions in a more thorough way, there's a lot to discuss about them. So let's jump in. And I'm going to do some demonstrations tonight with sound. But before I do that, we've got to get some basic terminology going. All right? So starting with this first question, what is a musical tone? Well, we need to understand some basics about sound first. Now, some of this stuff is probably familiar. How does a sound produced? What does it take to produce a sound? Something has to, you can say it out loud. Vibrate. I heard vibrate. Oscillate. You have to disturb the air around you. It's like dropping a rock in a lake. It disturbs the water. Energy is produced that ripples through the molecules of the water. Well, the same thing happens in sound. If I do, I disturb the sound and the waves go out. Okay? So in order to have a sound, something has to disturb the air. And you, I'm sure, know that the air is not empty. The air is full of billions of particles. It's full of stuff. So when you disturb that stuff, and here's the disturbance right here, is this red thing, whatever it is. Let's pretend that it's a guitar string. Okay, you pluck the guitar string. Well, the guitar string is doing this, right? So that's the red thing, but this is slowed way down, right? So, but it pushes the molecules next to it, and they mash together, and they create this moment of high pressure. And you know when things have high pressure, that's not stable, right? So those molecules mash together, and then they spring apart. Well, then they spring apart and mash to the molecules next to them, creating another area of high pressure, which then they spring apart and then mash together against the molecules. You follow? So you have these compressions, we have high pressure, and then moments that are called rarefactions of low pressure. And so the wave travels through the molecules in that way. I like that GIF. It's kind of cool. And it all actually kind of looks three-dimensional, too. It's hard to represent what's happening in three dimensions on a two-dimensional plane. Also, these little red dots are just example particles, just to show that the particles themselves are not traveling with the wave, right? They're just moving back and forth, but they're generally in the same place. The energy is going through those. Now, I wish, does anybody have any questions? I've got to ask it. We do have somebody with a mic, so even if you're way back there and you have a question, you could, like, shout it to him if I can't hear it. But I would love to have questions from the audience at any point. Now, down here is a two-dimensional representation of this in a different way. And this is a way that makes it convenient to analyze and study what are these waves doing and to depict them. And so this hill right here is the moment of the high pressure. Then it comes down to a point of neutral pressure. And then below that, the trough, is the low pressure point. Okay, so you can see the high pressure point, the low pressure point, and the wavelength, they measure the distance between that from crest to crest. Okay, you got all that? All right, so now, if we take one of those, there's two attributes that we need to talk about, a horizontal attribute and a vertical attribute. All right, the horizontal attribute is how many times is this compression and rarefaction happening per unit of time. We use a second, that's convenient. So how many times per second is it doing this? Okay? How many times per second? And that's called the frequency. So periods per second, or compressions per second. How many wavelengths per second? All right? So that's happening this way. So if you were, it's kind of like if you stand at a finish line of a race, and you're watching horses pass you by, how many horses per second are passing you by? Okay, that's frequency in sound. All right, the other thing is amplitude, which is every time it smashes together, how intensely is it smashing together? And that's amplitude, okay? And those two things are our basic terms we're going to be using the rest of the time, so you got to get them. You've got cycles per second, and what's interesting is frequency is what we perceive in our brain as pitch. So the faster the frequency, the higher the pitch, the faster it's going. The lower the frequency, the lower the pitch. And our hearing is about from around 20 hertz to about 20,000 hertz. And as you get older, some of those higher frequencies you become less sensitive to. And then amplitude, we measure in decibels. You probably heard that term. But that's how much pressure on every single one of those compressions is there. Okay? And that's what we perceive as the loudness of the sound. Okay, so frequency is how fast is it going, how fast is it, how many cycles per second in hertz. Amplitude is how intense are those compressions? And the frequency we perceive as pitch, amplitude as loudness. Any questions? Nobody's going to ask in this room. All right, so now let's do a demonstration. Because one of the first things we ask is, what is a musical tone? And let's see if I can flip over. Okay, good. I want to see if you can observe the difference between what we call music, a musical tone, and what we call noise. So I've got a few examples here. Which, sorry guys, I'll have to remember to switch. I know, it's going to be bad. That is 220 hertz. Okay, so if I zoom in, so here's a second. That's the first second. So there's 220 cycles happening per second. Now I'm going to zoom way in. You see it? Okay, that top one, that's your frequency. So it's going, it's compressing and refracting. It's compression and low pressure 100 or 220 times in a second. And it sounds like this. Okay. Now, let's hear trumpet. Now, did you notice that's the same pitch? Okay, so this pitch is, I said it's 220 hertz. That's an A. And for those of you that are in music, that's an A right below middle C. Okay, so it's right about in the middle of the piano. So the trumpet's playing that same pitch. Now let me play a violin sound. And then we're going to examine these. Pitch, right? But those sound very different than each other, don't they? Now let's take a look at a couple of noise sounds. Did you hear that? Too loud. It's glass breaking if you can't tell. Okay. And then something like, okay, now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to zoom in on these. Okay, so let's go back to my trumpet sound. I'm going to zoom in. Interesting. Okay, hold that thought. Now I'm going to go to the violin, and there's the violin zoomed in. Now, let's see down here in glass breaking. I have to scoot over. Let me go down here to the waves. Okay, here are the waves. Now, let me go back to, there's violin and trumpet. Do you see anything of characteristics about what you're seeing between trumpet and violin versus the waves? Call it out.
Repetition.
Thank you. Okay. Do you see the very clear pattern here? It starts here, it does this squiggly stuff, and then it does it all over again. Right? And the violin does lots of squiggly, squiggly stuff, but you can see a pattern in it with the compressions, everything. Whereas when you go down to the waves, there's not a pattern here. It's kind of all over the place. So we have demonstrated so far why we hear something as music versus noise, and that is because it's a periodic sound wave. Okay, something that has a repeating pattern to it, is what we perceive as a musical tone that sounds pleasant, right? As opposed to something we would call noise. Now, that's kind of interesting. And it's kind of cool already that we are receptive and sensitive to patterns, right? That's probably not news to anybody, but it certainly occurs here. Now, let's look a little, let's do another demonstration. You got a plug for me? With some other sounds, okay? So, demonstration here too, because we're going to demonstrate something else. Not switched yet, Adam. So here we've got a bunch of frequencies. All right, let me show this mixer view, and I'll show you what I have up here. And I've obviously stacked the deck a little bit, but that's all right. We've got 220 hertz, 440 hertz, 660, 880, 1100, 1320, and 1540. You can see from the visual, can't you, that these are faster than those, and those are faster, and those are faster. So you're fitting more in the same amount of time. Okay, so let's first play our 220 again. Okay. Now, I'm going to play 440 by itself. Let's hear that. I want you to, can you hum this? Now, guys, you're already cheating. It's not down here. It's up here. It's where the pitch actually is. Everybody hum this. Come on. All right. Good. Good. All right. Now, so that's 220. Now, we're going to hear this one.
Is that the same? Nope.
That is actually double the first one, right? Now, the lower one was an A. That one, in music, we also call an A. And why is that? Listen to the first one again. And then 440. Those sounds are so similar to each other that we call them the same thing. That's called an octave. All right? But that's not actually the point of what I'm talking about at this moment. Now, I'm going to play them together. Hum the pitch. Man, it's not down here. It's up here. Now, wait a second. We're playing, how many frequencies are we playing? Two. How many pitches did you hear? One. That's weird. Now, I'm going to go over here to 660. Let's listen to this one.
Now, is that the same pitch?
No, totally different, right? Now, I'm going to play all three of them. Is that this?
Now,
do you understand that I was playing three of them at the same time? Do it again. That's the same pitch, isn't it? I'm playing three frequencies, but you're hearing the same pitch. Are you with me? Some of you are like, duh. Some of you are like, whoa, I've never heard this before. Okay? I'm sure. So now, let's go to 880. Here, let me play it by itself. Definitely a different frequency, a different pitch, right? Now, let's put them all together.
I'm going to keep doing this. On the pitch.
same one, isn't it? Okay, let me add 1,100. On the pitch.
Here's 1,320. Also.
Hasn't changed yet. 1,540. What is happening? Oops. What just happened? Now, I played 220, I played 440, I played all of these frequencies at the same time, and your brain took all of them and perceived them as a single tone, which we would call in music A3, the A with low middle C. Now, this is really important to get. You heard all of those frequencies at the same time, but you perceived them as a single tone. How are you doing that? Well, here's part of the reason why. That's a big question. Why do we do that? Why would our brains even do that? Right? That's a big question. And it takes a lot to answer it, but we're going to start with an initial discovery that was made in the 19th century by a man named Jean-Baptiste Fourier. If you're in physics, I'm sure you've heard his name. Because what he discovered was any periodic vibration, and remember, we're talking about periodic vibrations, right? Not what we would call noise, but something that has a repeating pattern. Any periodic vibration, however complicated, can be represented as the combination of pure harmonic vibrations. So let me translate. One musical tone does not necessarily equal one frequency. Those things are not equal. Okay? When you hear an A3 and call it 220, that doesn't mean that it's just 220. One musical tone often means, well, if it's a musical instrument, it means many frequencies at once. A single musical tone played or sung by an instrument is a series of simultaneous frequencies, not just one. In other words, what are we talking about with pure versus complex? Oh, fantastic. Sorry, technical issues, everyone. It doesn't say that it's charging. Anybody else have Mac cord on you? Todd, do you have the plug? All right. Well, we'll keep it exciting. Okay, so he talked about pure vibrations versus complex in that definition. So a pure periodic vibration looks like this. We've already seen those, right? And just a little reminder, this is what it would sound like. Or not. So, right. We've already heard them. It was when you hear 220 by itself. That's rarely heard in the natural world. The closest thing would be like a tuning fork. If you have one of those and played with it, that's generally a single frequency. However, most sounds don't look like that. Most sounds are like this. And, of course, we already saw a couple with the trumpet and the violin. Those are complex sounds, and they're a lot more squiggly, right? A lot more squigglies. So what Fourier discovered is you can take something like that, as long as it's periodic, which would be like a musical instrument sound, and you can analyze it using a mathematical derivation that he discovered. And actually, what's going on is all that. Let me show that again. So this frequency, now it's a single tone. Let's see if this plays. Nope. The trumpet sound, that single tone, is actually all of this going on at the same time, which we kind of already proved because somehow your brain actually knew this already. So let's describe what this is. These are, I forgot to show, the term up here for these pure ones is called a sine wave. You guys remember trigonometry? Remember your sine function, sine, cosine, tangent, all that stuff? When you graph a sine function, it has an up and down curvature like that. Well, sine function is a great way to graph a sound wave. And so what Fourier says, you can reconstruct this periodic complex vibration as a series of sine waves. Okay? So these are all sine waves. Now let's look at them. Here's this red one, and it's the largest, right? It's got the highest amplitude anywhere. That's our vertical. All right, but is it the fastest frequency? No, it's not. It's the slowest. Okay, there's one period right there. And that's what we call, when we analyze it, we call that our first harmonic. Okay, this is called Fourier analysis, which gives you frequencies that follow the harmonic series. I'll talk more about that. So this first one is called our first harmonic. The next one is this blue one. And of course, it's going twice as fast as that one. The third one is here, this green one. You can see in there. The fourth one is this blue, five, and so on. These little equations here, don't let them scare you, but basically each of these sine waves you can graph using a particular function, and it has a very clear pattern. And probably you've already picked up on the pattern. Harmonic series is an existing pattern in math. So I've picked all these frequencies on purpose to put them together. So we've already said these are called harmonics of a sound. So you label them all, number them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all, so on. Now you've noticed the relationship probably. What's a relationship? Yeah, 440 and 220. 440 is double, right? And then 660 is triple the first one, right? And so on and so on. Okay, root for me. Oh, thank you. All right. Everyone can breathe. I'm not going to shut down in the middle of this and have this awkward moment. All right. So we got 2 times the first one, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, etc. So it follows a very clear pattern. And so when you analyze a complex tone into its component frequencies, the harmonics of it, you're finding the harmonic spectrum. Now, the first one also has a special name. It's called the fundamental. All right, so just remember that word. So what is a musical tone? It's a periodic vibration. And then what we learned is periodic vibration often, particularly with instruments, contains many frequencies which can be analyzed through Fourier analysis. And then the relationships of these frequencies to each other follow the harmonic series. So we perceive the fundamental frequency as the pitch. There's a lot of them, but we perceive the fundamental, the first one, as the pitch. So what are we doing with all those other frequencies? What's happening with all those? Let's demonstrate that. So we're going to go back here. I'm going to go to my mixer board here. We've got all of our frequencies. Now, I want to just first, we're going to mute everything except for the first one. Okay. And then, just to remind, here's all of them. What changed? The pitch didn't change, right? Well, think about what's changing. Here, I'm going to play with it a little bit more. What's changing? I'm going to play them all and adjust things. Does that sound like anything to you? First of all, what changed? What changed? The pitch didn't change, right? So what changed? The amplitudes, right. So I changed amplitudes of the frequencies. I turned some of them down. So I changed the pressure of the amplitudes. But what changed in your perception? Huh? It got quieter? Okay. Well, I mean, I took some out. Is there anything else that changed? The what? The sound was complex, yes. Let's do... Okay, there's your original one. It's kind of hard to describe, actually. What's changing? It's kind of the quality of the sound, would you say? Like, it's the same pitch, but it doesn't sound maybe like the same instrument playing it. Right? There's something different about the quality of the sound. Well, it's kind of hard to describe, actually. But there's this particular word we have for that, which is called timbre. Okay, it's the timbre of the sound. And this is the answer to our question, our second question. So what did I do? I had amplitudes of all those frequencies, and I adjusted them. Okay, and I pulled some of them down and left some of them where they were. And so we perceive the harmonic spectrum of a sound as the quality of the sound or the timbre of the tone. So those aren't wasted frequencies, right? We're hearing all of that. We're processing the fundamental as the pitch, and then the rest of it, based on the pattern of the relative intensities of those frequencies to each other, we perceive that as, oh, that's a violin. Oh, that's a trumpet. Oh, that's a singer. Oh, that's my refrigerator. Do you follow? So our second question is, why does this happen? Why do we hear different instruments, even if they're playing the same pitch? Because certain objects, like musical instruments, can produce multiple frequencies of the harmonic series simultaneously. Your piano string, your guitar string, your saxophone, your clarinet, the properties of those instruments allow them to produce all these frequencies at the same time. And you can go into physics and you can actually calculate what the fundamental frequency is going to be of a tube so long, depending on its length and its mass. And the tension on a string, you can calculate what's the lowest fundamental frequency going to be, and then you can calculate all the harmonics from that, so you can know exactly what it's going to play, which is how instruments are made. And then our brain somehow knows about that, and so we can hear all those frequencies at the same time and process it into a, well, isn't that a lovely sound, assuming they know how to play their instrument, as the quality of the sound. Is your brain starting to explode a little bit, if you didn't know that before? The harmonic series also helps us explain dissonance. You're like, oh boy, we could hear that. So, here we go. So here is 220 and 230. Okay, so 230 is very close, right? I'll try to stand back away from the laptop, Adam. Maybe it won't be so bad then. All right. Here's 220. Yeah, that's even worse for the computer, I think, than it is for you. because those frequencies are so close together, they cause what's called beating. And you can imagine if the 220 is going like this, 230 is just a little bit faster, so it's just going to be right off from the other one the whole time. And the thing is, machines, our ears pick that up, and we hear this beat in the sound because of it. I'm not even going to play 311 because it's terrible. It just sounds like growling. But that explains dissonance, too. Because interestingly, in the history of music, the harmonic series explains are the most consonant sounding things to human beings. So let me go back to my series here. We already talked about the first that when you double the frequency, you get an octave. The octave is the most consonant thing to our ears, and there's a physical reason for that. We'll see a little bit later, hopefully. I've about to run out of time. This, from here to here, is a fifth. What's called a perfect fifth in music. Which is also, if you listen to like medieval chant and stuff, their music was based around the octave and the fifth and this next one, which is the fourth. because they thought those are the most perfect sounding things. And then, over time in the Renaissance, we started to add some more relationships that we thought sounded better. And then over time, we've added lots of stuff that even sounds dissonant, but now we like it because we've just gotten used to it. But the history of music is actually going through the harmonic series and gradually adding more of those relationships into our music. So it's had an impact in a lot of ways. Now, one other thing I want to show, before I run out of time, one other demonstration here. Let me go back to my mixer again. So we've got all our sounds here. I'm going to put some of these back up. So we've got all of them playing. Now, I'm going to remove something. What did I do? I removed the fundamental. Let me put it back in. Hum that pitch. Okay, now I'm going to remove it. Hum that pitch. What do you mean? I took away the 220. Why are you still humming 220? No, I'm going to take away 440. Hum that pitch. What? I'm going to take away 660. Let's see how far we can go. Still humming that pitch. I'm starting to lose it, right? What does that mean that's happening? What does that mean? That means I took away the 220, but my brain knows this pattern so well, I actually fill 220 in. Because I know it ought to be there. Did somebody teach you to do that? How do you learn to do that? And we haven't even talked about the mechanism for how that's happening yet. But I even took out 440 and 660, but my brain knows this pattern so well that it's going to fill it in. This is still 220, because I know what the pattern of 220 is supposed to be. Now, I'm already out of time, and I was going to do some more stuff, but that's all right. Maybe we'll try to get to it Wednesday. So, what just happened? Even though the fundamental frequency is missing, our brains will fill in the gap, and even some other ones too. And again, so what I want you to get from tonight is this free analysis. Now, I have 2 minutes, so I got to do this. We may not show it, but just to like really hammer this home, when we're singing together in worship or anywhere, when you're hearing multiple notes at the same time, what is your brain actually processing? I would like for your brain to explode, right? So I want to try to emphasize, what is your brain actually processing? So here's a standard chord that we would sing, right? And if I had more time, I'd have us all sing it. Here's a standard chord that we would all sing, right? Bass is on a C, tenor's on a G, alto's E, C. Now, let's think about it. When the bassists are singing a G, if I sing a C, what am I actually hearing? Well, I can't really even sing right now, but I'm singing that note, right? But that's not all I'm hearing, right? If I'm a musical instrument, I produce multiple frequencies at the same time. So the fundamental is 130, but I'm producing more stuff. I'm producing an octave higher. I'm producing a fifth above that. I'm producing a fourth above that. I'm producing a third above. I'm producing all these frequencies. And the relative intensities, the amplitudes of all those, are what help you identify that it's my voice. And, of course, even among humans, we produce a different array of relative intensities in our voice, and so you can tell it's not me, it's him. Even with two males or two females, it's like our signature. Okay? So we're hearing all of that in just the basses. Now, of course, the basses are probably not singing exactly 130, especially if you have a bunch of them. You might have something like 135 and something like 120, right? But if we have enough people, your brain kind of like, oh, that's close enough. And puts it together so you don't go crazy. Now, maybe some of you go crazy. But generally, we kind of like, oh, that's pretty good. Now, we perceive that one as a pitch. All the rest of this is the signature of the instrument, right? The singer. Now, let's go to G. We'll keep going through this. The fundamental, we're hearing these other frequencies at the same time. Right? I'm going to keep going through. That's the fundamental that we perceive. I'm going. E, same thing. We're hearing lots of stuff above that. So as we get through here, get to the last one, we have all of these going at the same time. And this, again, why do these sound good together? It's because a lot of their harmonics are equivalent. And so it helps things feel like they lock together and that they sound good together. And when we're singing, we have this fuller experience. We're singing all these notes together because you see how many of them overlap. And also, real quickly, we know that this is a C, and this is a C. All of their harmonics are the same because it's the same pitch. All of their harmonics are exactly the same. They're just an octave higher. They're doubled. So that's why those are the most consonant-sounding things to us. So all of this together, our ear is processing who knows how many frequencies when we're hearing this, and we're enjoying this nice chord, and we don't think a thing about it. Now, there's another question is, how do I distinguish that there are four notes here when I have all these frequencies and they're all kind of overlapping? We don't know. Your brain just does it. We'll talk a little bit more about that on Wednesday. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. All right, let's end with a prayer. Thank you for your attention. Father, we are excited to look into your world. Thank you for the time that we've had to do it. Even the smallest moment and smallest creature that you have made is full of so much complexity. Help us to appreciate your design and to worship you as the creator. In Jesus' name, amen.